Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. And it's a lot of drama, a lot of political drama this morning. So the Sunday Times is following up on their story last week about Cobalt, the alleged Russian spy in the alleged Oireachtas. And they have more details, and it sounds as if Cobalt, according to this, might have been a bit more active than we might have thought. More recently, he was discreetly approaching ministers via messaging apps and social media, seeking private meetings on sensitive and divisive issues, according to this story by John Mooney. And texts seen by the Sunday Times indicate he sought to pit cabinet colleagues against each other. So that's that as regards kind of breaking political news. So the ostensible lead in the Sunday Independent is Michael O'Leary saying they're going to win a court case on the passenger cap. And we might come back to that. But I think their real lead is Kate O'Connell turns down Simon Harris for an election solo run. So Kate O'Connell is saying she will run as an independent in Dublin Bay South. She does not want to be anyone's sweeper. And not to be outdone, Fine Gael have announced this morning that they have selected Councillor Emma Blaine to contest Dublin Bay South constituency in the general election. This is following a meeting of Fine Gael's Executive Council yesterday. So she has been added to the ticket there, as they say. The Business Post funding crunch holding back housing push, developers warn. So basically, obviously, we made the banks get sense, but now do the banks have too much sense? And builders, and particularly, I think, smaller, medium-sized developers saying they can't get enough money to build all the houses we need in this country and the banks need to step up a bit. The Sunday Mirror playing crazy. Travellers face €800 return fares as a passenger cap takes hold. This is industry expert Owen Carey saying this. And the Sunday World is leading with McGovern in Dubai hellhole. This is Sean McGovern, the senior Kinahan gang member, who, as we know, has been arrested in Dubai. There are varying opinions across the papers today, I would say, as to whether that extradition of him to Ireland runs kind of smoothly and is, as one paper says, a kind of a dress rehearsal for the ultimate sending back of the Kinahans here, or whether it will ever happen at all. Indeed, the Sun on Sunday is never let this monster go free, and this is Hazel Behan, and you will remember Hazel Behan. Christian Bruckner, who is the Madeleine McCann suspect, was acquitted of raping Hazel Behan and others in Portugal. He's still behind bars for raping a US pensioner in 2005. But Hazel Behan says this man poses a threat to women. And the Irish Mail on Sunday is leading with the niece of shamed Bishop Eamon Casey, who claims her uncle sexually abused her as a child, has called on the Catholic Church to remove his remains from the crypt in Galway Cathedral. Indeed, she says that she was abused by Casey in that very cathedral. And then, of course, there is the breaking news that was too late for all the papers. And that is about the resignation from Sinn Féin of Leigh Shoffley TD Brian Stanley. So look, let's meet our panel first. Bobby McDonagh is a former Irish ambassador to the UK, the EU and Italy. Sarah McGuinness is political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. Ciara Murphy is a senior policy officer at the ESRI. And Professor Gary Murphy is a professor of politics at DCU. Good morning, everybody.
Morning. Morning, Brendan.
So look, we might start with the most breaking news, which is the resignation of Brian Stanley. So I'll just read you there what we have so far. So Brian Stanley, in his statement, says he will now remain a Republican TD outside the party. He says his decision to quit follows on from a complaint that saw him brought before an internal party inquiry. He described the inquiry process as flawed. Indeed, he used what is quite a loaded phrase to use in the Sinn Féin context, which is kangaroo court, which invokes other legacy issues in Sinn Féin. He says, considering what I have experienced and how Sinn Féin has dealt with this and other matters across the wider party in recent months, I can no longer have confidence in it. So that was revealed last night on I think Leash Today. We contacted Brian Stanley this morning. We asked him to elaborate or to confirm whether he will stand at the next election. We haven't yet had a response from him. We've asked Sinn Féin for a statement. We haven't received one yet. Meanwhile, as you heard there on the news, on News Talk this morning, Sinn Féin MEP Lynn Boylan has accused Brian Stanley of putting out half a story, and she urged him to reveal the complaint that led to the internal party investigation being launched. She said Brian could end all this today and could actually tell people what he was being investigated for if he felt so hard done by in terms of the process. OK, so Gary, without getting into the ins and outs of Brian Stanley, this caps off the week from hell for Sinn Féin, really, doesn't it? It's a bad week.
Oh, it does, Brendan. Yeah, it's an unmitigated disaster, I would say, for the party. So Brian Stanley, he is no Johnny come lately to Sinn Féin. He is a member since the mid 1980s, when he was in his mid 20s, and there is no great political kudos for joining Sinn Féin in the mid 1980s in Laois, of all places, and he's built up the party there within the constituency and has become a very prominent member of it. And people will know him mainly in recent years because of his chairmanship of the state's and the Oireachtas' most important committee, the Public Accounts Committee.
He was a big brand for Sinn Féin.
Yeah, he is a big brand. He is a person with long-standing commitment to the party, and people will know him, as I said, for the PAC, where he has led the charge on payments in RTE, the Children's Hospital, and other overspends in the government firmament. So for him to resign and to use the term kangaroo court seems to me quite extraordinary and quite deliberate. And
we don't know what the process was, and we don't know what the accusations were, but
that term has like long connotations with the Republican movement. And he said that he would remain a Republican, as you said, Brendan, in your introduction, an independent Republican TD. I would be amazed if he doesn't run, and I would be equally amazed if he doesn't run and retains his seat. But there it is. The culmination after Patricia Ryan in Kildare South resigning again in a bitter acrimony, where she accused basically the party hierarchy of undermining her. We had Violet Ann Wynne in Clare a number of years ago making the exact same allegations that the party had undermined her. And it brings back this idea which Sinn Féin in the Republic had been trying to get rid of for a long time, but are not succeeding, as we can see particularly this week, that it is run by shadowy figures from Belfast or from the north. And when we expect maybe an election to be called literally next week, it's hard to think of a party going into a campaign, if it is called next, or even in February, on the back of such terrible news.
Okay, Sarah, he will be a big loss.
Huge loss for all the reasons that Gary outlined. And you know, like Sinn Féin have their kind of smallish cohort of people that they like to put out there who are very public facing. Brian Stanley was not one of them, but he was still really highly regarded among party members. I was at the Sinn Féin Ardèche there 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and I was standing in the same spot for about 45 minutes trying to get a glimpse of Gerry Adams. But Brian Stanley was standing there, as he was standing nearby as well. And there were just constantly people coming up to him, you know, like he seemed to be super well regarded within the party. And as Gary mentioned, you know, like he proved himself very capable around last summer around the RTE controversy and kind of his handling of that. He's kind of seen as firm but fair. And Sinn Féin will really be in a spot of trouble if he takes that seat with him, if he runs again and he gets elected, which is looking very likely, you know. And it kind of speaks to it speaks to this culture that, you know, if you're losing, if you're bleeding members, which they are right now, and those seats are going with them, well, then what are you left with? You know, you're left with the same five or six people that, you know, are the only ones who kind of get a word in edgeways in the Dáil or in media. It will be a blow. Yeah, it for sure will be a blow.
Bobby, you're not probably not as part of the political, economic, academic firmament as our two speakers so far. But even as a kind of officious bystander, does this create a narrative, a slightly chaotic, unravelling-y narrative around Sinn Féin, the events of the last week?
I think it does. As you say, it's difficult to comment because it's, in a sense, subdued to say. And all parties have their ups and downs and will have them in future, but Sinn Féin clearly has it down at the moment. And it does seem to make an early election all that more likely.
Yeah. Does that, if you were, Sarah, the coalition now, would you be thinking, let's just do it now?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, like Fine Gael have repeatedly gotten election timings wrong and their leaders have always been chastised for it. So I think if Simon Harris waits until February and the election doesn't pan out the way they want to, they'll look back at this and they'll say Sinn Féin literally had, as you put it, the week from hell and you didn't call it the next week. Like, what's up with that? But also, I think what's really fascinating about this is Sinn Féin are such a tight-lipped party. This might be a bit inside baseball, but usually, you know, political parties meet every week. They have their parliamentary meetings. And
you
know,
leak like a sieve.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They kind of give briefings about what was said, you know, if there was a row, you know, journalists tend to find out about it. Sinn Féin is the only party that does not brief anyone. They are so tight-lipped. So I suppose...
Do you have sources in Sinn Féin?
Do I have sources in Sinn Féin?
No, but you know what I mean? I presume you have sources in all parties. Do you have
My foot's only in the door of Leinster House. So I'm trying to build some. But
I find a lot of pollsters don't have the same sources
they won't.
In Sinn Féin.
They are notoriously difficult to get any kind of insight out of as to how the party actually operates and what the dynamic is in there. But the glimpses that we've gotten over the past 2 weeks have been highly unflattering and, kind of very concerning, I imagine, to people within the party. I was doing ring arounds this week trying to get a sense of how the Michael McMonagall case, the handling of that, was being seen within the party members. You know, did they think that Mary Lou MacDonald and Michelle O'Neill should have come out sooner? Did they think that they should have been more forthright? Do they think it was right for Michelle O'Neill to say, I simply did not see Michael McMonagall standing 3 metres away from me in the Northern Irish Assembly? And they all had the same line. They were all kind of, we stand by how this has been handled. We think we took a swift and harsh approach. And it's always we, and there is no deviation from the leadership.
Well, of course, party discipline is a good thing too. Ciara, what do you think of all this?
I suppose, I mean, I'm also kind of not in the political world, but I think I see, Sinn Féin had to grow so quickly and into a very different party and a very different base. And you see, I think, the governance challenges that have come with that and maybe kind of the need to do
interesting
better. Yeah,
it's like a small family business that suddenly becomes a PLC, like, and their culture change is a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah,
then
and
when
you have a lot of new
leap.
Members coming in with a very different kind of background or base, I think, from before.
Yeah,
I just think other finding perhaps Brendan the statement by Brian Stanley is quite extraordinary because he really goes to the heart of or he goes on the attack about the leadership of the party and the way it's been run and the way it has been run in the recent past. And, you know, I think I would take slight issue with Lynn Boyle and her view that he could clear it up immediately. I mean, it's not his business to clear it up, what he's been accused of, especially if he thinks he's been accused completely in the wrong. So I would have my doubts about the efficacy of that. But it has been a terrible few weeks for Mary Lou MacDonald as the leader of the party. And
Gary, you picked Hugh O'Connor. Just before we get, I'll ask you about the election in a sec. Before we get to that, how scandal and conflict could topple Sinn Féin, Hugh O'Connell's piece in the Sunday Times today.
Yeah, and
how bad could this all be for Sinn Féin?
And Alison O'Connor also has a very good piece on Sinn Féin in the Sunday Times as well. It could be very bad. I mean, elections now are won during the campaign. I mean, there is a huge volatility in the electorate. And we saw it in 2020 when Sinn Féin came from their terrible local and European results of June 2019 to, you know, if they had ran more candidates, they could have ended up with 40-odd seats. Going into a campaign on the back of a senior member resigning and going down with sort of, to pardon the pun, all guns blazing, is a terrible look for any party. Sinn Féin want to talk about housing, you know, health and housing. And if you're in Fianna Gael or Fianna Fáil, well, you know, have a big door to run through and attack them with it. And I think it is very damaging for them, yeah, electorally speaking. On the election, no one ever won an election because of the time it was called, but loads of parties lose elections supposedly for the time they're called. I'm not a great believer in that theory myself. I think it's a bit of sort of like hindsight. But now does seem to be the opportune time for...
How quickly do you think they could get an election? Hugh O'Connell seems to be saying now the thinking is turning to December.
Yeah, the 6th of December, I think. Now you're getting pretty close to Christmas. And I mean,
apparently people are in good form though.
Well, Boris Johnson...
And they'll have their... pockets stuffed with extra.
Boris Johnson went as close as the last week, the 19th of December, I think it was, in 2019, in the British general election. Now, that would seem to be extraordinarily late. But you do run the risk of, again, bad weather, people are a bit grumpy if they're, issues arise, or events thereby, as Harold Macmillan would say. But it does seem to be, I think, the moment seems to be right now, I think.
Sarah?
Yeah, I think so. I was looking at the Dáil schedule and there's a couple of bits of legislation that the government needs to get through. So it needs to get the social welfare bill through. That's coming up this week. There's the finance bill, which is going for like the first stage debate in the Dáil. But like really that all can be put through quite quickly. And if you're looking at the first week of December, voters would have just gotten their second lump sum social welfare payment. The stars seem to be aligning for it, but you know, stranger things have happened in politics than to not call an election in this winter.
Yeah. Kira, from an economist perspective, if you're going to buy an election, probably a good idea to have the election when the payment is going through, is it?
Just to clarify, I'm not an economist. Yeah. My background is kind of law and social sciences more so. I was sighing in frustration there when you were mentioning the lump sum coming through and the election. I'm so frustrated with that approach to the budget this year. So I suppose, yeah, if that's your goal, probably. But
Gary mentioned housing there. Mm. And, you know, people always talk about what elections are going to be fought on and everything. And, you know, we fought elections on how well we did at Brexit and everything. And then the election itself turns out to be about something else. It does feel as if, though, Sinn Féin are struggling to get housing onto the agenda right now, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely feels like that when you kind of read the papers. But at the same time, my understanding is that Eurobarometer data is still showing that people say housing is the number one biggest issue facing the country.
Yeah.
So it's very much still a priority in a lot of people's minds. But I don't know if, and I think there was an interesting piece in the Business Post on kind of how, or one of the papers on how the election is turning into this politicking rather than the substance and policy, which I think is a shame.
Okay, yeah, but we will only see when the campaigns start what it pivots back to.
Just a general point, despite all the political and the faults of all the political parties, we are very lucky with our politics in this country. When you compare us to what's happening in the United States, what happened in the UK, we have, you know, a very strong media that holds people to account in a way that doesn't happen in many other countries. You have Boris Johnson back out selling his autobiography, even though he resigned and was forced to resign by 50 ministers, leaving his government because he had deceived Parliament. And in our case, if you look at, say, the Sinn Féin issue now, we should recognise that our media do a really good job. And they do a good job in other parties when they make mistakes as well. In some other democracies, people can escape from that sort of scrutiny. So I just think with an election coming up, we can criticise all the parties, but we're really pretty lucky. You know, I believe that optimism is a policy, but yeah. I do think we're lucky
in
this country.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Sarah, tell us then about the front of the Sunday Independent, Kate O'Connell.
Yeah, so Kate O'Connell has said that she will not run with Fine Gael in Dublin Bay South, and she is going to go out on her own. And basically she said she's not going to be a sweeper for anyone. She's not going to be a second choice. And, you know, that's that. And I suppose it would come out as a bit of a surprise to Simon Harris. You know, Kate O'Connell kind of rejoiced very publicly when Leo Varadkar resigned as Indeed. Leader of Fine Gael. And she embraced Simon Harris and she kind of said, oh, this dark era in the party is over and, you know, the Messiah has come. Not those words exactly. I'm exaggerating, but you get it. Yeah. You know what I'm getting at.
I think Simon Harris probably does think he's the Messiah.
Well, everyone's everyone's telling him he is. The opinion polls are telling him he is. Was it the most popular party leader ever in Irish politics?
Really?
That was a recent opinion poll. I think it was the Irish Times Ipsos one. 55% of people say he's their... Like, say he's the top.
Since
man
polling
them.
Began there, they didn't have polling in Dev's time. It would have been
100%. No, that's true. Yeah, you're dead right on that one, Brendan. But anyway, so Kate O'Connell is saying she's not going to go. And I suppose this is kind of coming on the back of like a kind of difficult period in politics for Kate O'Connell. You know, she narrowly lost her seat in 2020. The Dublin Bay South by-election came up in 2021. And Fine Gael decided, you know what, James Gagan, the councillor, the local councillor there, he's our man, we're going to run him. And she wasn't happy about that, which is fair enough. And, you know, after James Gagan lost that seat and Ivana Bacic won it, everyone was kind of, you should have run Kate there. And, you know, there was a whole thing around that time. There was something bizarre, like there was a fake social media post going around of perpetuating Kate O'Connell endorsing Ivana Bacic as opposed to James Gagan. Now, she has refuted that that came from her. But, you know, it was quite a fiery exchange. I wouldn't say that Kate O'Connell and James Gagan are the best of friends, but this definitely will probably come as a surprise to Simon Harris. And it's kind of an interesting trend, I suppose, that we've seen in recent weeks that, you know, kind of party stalwarts, for lack of a better word, you know, Brian Stanley, Patricia Ryan was in Fine Gael for years. She set up her local Cumann in Kildare. Sinn Féin, sorry. She set up her local Sinn Féin Cumann in Kildare. And, you know, I suppose it's kind of interesting seeing the volume of politicians. Now, maybe this happens around every general election, but kind of seeing independent candidacy as a viable option, you know, that they can still get their name out there, that they don't necessarily have to be tied to a party and within a fold in order to kind of make an impact or get a seat. So that's kind of been an interesting development in recent weeks.
So, Gary, there's a whole soap opera here, as Sarah was alluding to, in that constituency in her own Kate O'Connell and involving sods of turf and all kinds of stuff. So now we're going to have a situation where Fine Gael, currently no seat there, running two candidates, Emma Blane now added to the ticket, and Kate O'Connell looking for that same seat?
Apparently so. And she does say in that exclusive by Fionn Hon Sí and that she's up against it. But then she lists the people she's up against, including a rather derogatory comment, a nice fella from the Social Democrats. She's a spiky, acerbic character. I've been on this panel in the studio with her a few times. She won a seat in 2016, lost it narrowly, as Sarah said, in 2020. Owen Murphy was her running mate. And then when he resigned to go off to Vienna and to that nuclear power think tank, it was assumed, I think, by many that she would be the obvious replacement. But she has history with the leadership of the party and your allusion to turf. So basically, she's originally from Westmead. I think there's a view of many in Dublin Bay South, which is the bluest of blue blood constituencies. This is the old Gareth Fitzgerald constituency, for instance. James Gagan, he is the son of two Supreme Court justices. So there is that sort of blue blood versus blow intention, I think, that has been there. And apparently somebody came to a constituency meeting with a sod of turf in their bag as a derogatory comment on Kate O'Connell, which seems an extraordinary thing to do. She's high profile. She's extremely articulate. Will she win a seat? I mean, running as an independent in one way in Ireland is ideal because we elect lots of independents. We particularly elect them in volatile times like we're living in now.
She has a big personal brand.
She does.
Not everyone announcing that they were going to run as an independent TD would be a big, huge picture on the front page story on the Sunday Independent.
But you need canvassers, you need people on the ground. Fine Gael has that organisation that now is not available to her. And in that particular constituency, which Sarah alluded, is brutally tough. You have Chris Andrews, formerly Fianna Fáil, now Sinn Féin TD. You have Jim O'Callaghan, high profile Fianna Fáil TD, who's had his own run-ins with the Fianna Fáil leadership. You have Ivana Bacic.
Fine Gael are looking to take out Jim O'Callaghan, is one of the seats they feel they could take out, is it?
Yeah, but they're looking to go from no seats to two seats, which is a bit of an ask, I think. Yeah. And I think they'll be doing well to win one seat. The other interesting point in Fiona Hahn's article is Kate O'Connell has a go at both the Fine Gael candidates as not living in the constituency of which she actually is. And that's always a sort of an odd look, I think, for a political party if you're running two candidates and neither live in the constituency.
Okay, I'm not sure about the candidate announced yesterday. No, but
no, she says that both Emma Blaine and James Gage.
Yeah, okay,
well,
sorry,
Kate,
yeah,
I don't know myself. I don't know where I know where Emma lives.
Okay,
but that's what Kate is saying.
Okay, so she
in the
has
paper,
that there. Yeah, all right. Okay, Bobby. The Cobalt story has now been running a week, which is never a good sign with a story. That means it's not going away. You have picked John Mooney again, who broke this story last week in the Sunday Times. And that front page story, warnings at top level of Russian spy since 2018. So we know that Micheál Martin says he was never told anything about this. But now it seems at least one minister was told and various other people in government as well, or in the civil service, certainly.
Yes, Brendan. Micheál Martin says that he wasn't told about this specific case, but I'm pretty sure that the broad thrust of the story is correct and that Micheál Martin will be aware of it. In other words, the attempts of the Russian embassy in Dublin and the Russians more generally to exercise influence that goes beyond their diplomatic role. We know that they had far more staff of their embassy than they needed for diplomatic duties. They tried to expand the physical infrastructure in a way that wasn't necessary for the embassy. So, I mean, I find that without knowing anything about the specific Cobalt case, I find the broad thrust very plausible. I mean, I also find plausible the report in the paper that that Cobalt, whoever he or she may be, lacked access to confidential information. That's also quite possible because it's possible both to try and run an espionage network and also be pretty dumb. I think
it is. Will you explain to me a little bit about how this kind of thing might work from what you know? Because we have, like, I never thought I'd be quoting Yuri Filatov, but we have him saying, look, this is what diplomacy is about. You try and make friends with people in the arts and culture and media and, you know, that kind of thing. That is normal diplomacy to court people and everything.
I'm sure there are
and
some
then,
diplomats.
And then there's a line at some point that gets crossed.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, obviously,
is it a blurred line?
No, I don't think it's particularly blurred. I mean, every embassy in every country seeks to get to know people in the country. It's their job, and I'm sure there are some diplomats.
We know that
Russia has been trying to undermine democracy around the world by supporting right-wing parties, by giving them money, by interfering in the Brexit election, by interfering in America, and so on. So there's also no doubt that that they go beyond what the normal diplomatic role is. And it's something that we should be very worried about. When you ask me how this sort of thing happened, I could give you one example, if you like, in my own case.
Go on.
So I don't know whether this was an approach by the Russians, but about 6 or 7 years ago, I went to a meeting in Eastern Europe of senior EU officials. And at breakfast, I was directed to a table to sit on my own by the hotel staff. And when I came back, having served myself some breakfast, there was a young woman at the table. And she said she was a Russian businesswoman in town for a couple of days, even though there were plenty of other empty tables available. So I chatted to her for a few minutes, and then the senior British official came into the breakfast room, and he knew me, he came over, said, can I sit with you? And I said, sure. And then I explained that I'd been sitting at the table with this young Russian woman, and she left after a few minutes. And then he said to me, I hope that wasn't a honey trap. So I laughed. I said, oh, God, that's ridiculous. But about a year later, I was talking to a Garda who works in this area. And I said, let me just run something past you. And he said, that's more likely than not. That was an approach. And he said, that's exactly the way things happen. So I'm not certain that that's what
it
was.
Were you disappointed? You thought she just liked you for yourself?
No. I accepted her cover story she had been assigned
to the
table.
Room and thought, hmm.
So basically, I might have been approached, but I was so innocent that I didn't realise it at the time.
Okay. Listen, God bless your innocence. Sarah, you've been around Leinster House this week. Has it been fever pitch, the cobalt chatter?
Oh, yeah. The Shannon in particular is kind of alive with who's cobalt. And there was a hilarious, a couple of hilarious denouncements. It was compared to the opposite of I am Spartacus, I am not a Russian spy, started by Timmy Dooley in the Shannon. And four or five other senators also took their opportunity to say that it wasn't them, which is the exact thing that a spy would say. But anyway, we'll leave that off. But yeah, no, particularly in and around the Shannon, and there's been a couple of names circulating, which I will not say, obviously.
You absolutely
on air.
No,
I will not say. But yeah, there's a lot of chatter about it at the minute. It was interesting to hear Micheál Martin's comments on it at Leaders' Questions during the week. Like, he was kind of more so saying that he's not really concerned about the fact that people, like, that someone in the Oireachtas had been approached by a Russian agent. He was more so concerned that A, he wasn't alerted to it, and B, that it got out in the first place. So yeah, I think it's definitely raised the question of our, you know, kind of security and defence frameworks. But yeah. I don't know. There's a lot of the papers, including Gary was writing in the Sunday Times today, whether this is a case of Carry On or John Le Carré. And I think it's, you know, the Sunday Times article, John Mooney himself wrote today that the extent of the damage that this might have caused has yet to be revealed. And I don't know if it ever will be revealed. I don't know if it's caused that much damage. But anyway, it's been a source of speculation, definitely, yeah, in Leinster House this week.
See, Ciara, I think a thing can be both a joke and deadly serious, and cause us to think about our security. We do tend to think we're immune from all this kind of stuff, don't we, as a country?
Yeah, that's kind of my perception. I've been really surprised by how flippant people have been about it. I suppose I've lived in quite a few countries where people take security much more seriously than they do in Ireland. I think we got used to, for a long time, kind of being on the edge of things, being kind of maybe too poor or too neutral, so people didn't really think about us. But I think John Mooney's piece really highlights how, you know, we're seen as kind of a weak spot in Europe, and you know, there was kind of Russia was using the embassy to get to other areas in Europe, and how we have a lot of strategic infrastructure too. So I think we need to maybe not be so naive,
yeah,
as a population, and kind of, and it's not just the political class, I think it's also just normal citizens, and realise that we are now much more important and take this much more seriously than we have.
Like, Gary, our kind of attitude to the rest of the world for a long time was everybody loves the Irish, let's see what we can get out of them kind of thing, wasn't it? But times are changing.
Yeah, it was, and they are, Brendan. I make the point in my own column is look where the Russians have tried to interfere. They tried to interfere in the Catalan independence referendum. They tried to interfere in the Scottish independence referendum. They tried to interfere in Brexit. The Germans issued a formal complaint to Russia over the 2021 German federal election. You had a French presidential election, the hacking of Hillary Clinton's private server in the United States in 2016, France in 2017. All across sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia, the Russians have been trying to manipulate elections. And we'd be very naive, to Ciara's point, if we thought that this couldn't happen here. And that's why I think the cobalt story is more important. I know Eilish O'Hanlon has a very good piece, Spiciness is the Stuff of Carry On, not John Le Carré. I tend to have a different view, and that's why I think John Mooney's story is...
Well, Eilish does end up saying we need to take our security more seriously. Like, that is...
Yeah, and Bobby would know more than probably anyone.
She does have a good line about the I am Spartacus, that when we heard who there's a Russian spy, everyone didn't immediately think, oh, it's probably Timmy Dooley, and that Timmy Dooley had to come out straight away.
And there's a very good pull-out quote. Having sex with sultry Russian agents is not a crime or evidence of treason. 007 does it all the time. No one questions his patriotism. But as Bobby would know more than anybody, we spend a pittance on security and defence here. That's not going to be an issue in the coming general election, and maybe it should.
Yeah, Ciara.
Yeah, just, I suppose, we can think about this in terms of defence, but I think what my understanding is what the Russians tend to do is sow division. And I think one question we really need to ask as well is, where are we vulnerable to that? Where is there fertile ground for that?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there currently are significant tensions, but around, you know, economic choices, infrastructure, housing, and, you know, and then that, I think, turning into this anti-immigrant sentiment as well. So I think that needs to be a conversation as well in terms of our society. Is there a way we can make ourselves less resilient or more resilient to that divisiveness?
Yeah, yeah, because it's an unknown unknown, really. Like, we don't know how much of the kind of carping and tension in our society is being egged on by this. Okay, we take a break. Bobby McDonough, Sarah McGuinness, Ciara Murphy and Professor Gary Murphy staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Bobby McDonough, Sarah McGuinness, Ciara Murphy and Professor Gary Murphy. Ciara, the Sunday Business Post have a piece and they've been banging this drum a lot, and it's kind of right throughout their paper again today. Ian Guider's writing, our smug complacency is costing us jobs and investment as Britain is now eating our lunch as well.
Yeah, so this piece is basically about kind of competitiveness and about the UK's new government really going hard after foreign direct investment and kind of multinational investors, who, of course, Ireland has been winning a lot of investment from and we're very dependent on for our tax take. And essentially how, you know, massive threats to our competitiveness are really eating away at our capacity to attract these. So I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about, for example, the data centres, but I think really what things like the National Competitiveness and Productivity Council are saying is infrastructure is really one of the big threats to competitiveness at the moment. So I think we're really seeing the cost of not investing in that over time.
And we've seen decisions recently, haven't we? Intel, I think, Amazon Web Services, we've seen decisions not go towards Ireland and starting to go to other European countries, haven't we?
Yeah, and they cite kind of decisions for AI data centres going towards the UK, I think, you know, and kind of say Ireland would have been considered in that, but not.
Are we complacent? Are we like a smug, fat pig now, like blown up on all this corporation tax and thinking it'll always keep coming?
I don't think so. I mean, there's so much conversation about how vulnerable that tax is, but I think that really what we're seeing is the cost of the austerity measures that just put off, infrastructure investment for such a long time.
And you include housing and infrastructure.
Housing, you know, water, you know, I think the National Product, that council basically said, you know, wastewater, electricity and I think housing were the biggest ones that they highlighted, but we're way below European averages in a lot of different infrastructure areas. And things like, I know the editor of the Business Post also highlighted underfunding of universities, these kind of strategic innovation hubs, and how you're just completely
lacking. Because that's what brings a cluster of industry to a place. And often if you see a cluster of pharma or whatever, it tends to be around a university that will tailor itself to feed into that kind of business, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of literature on how, you know, our education, investment in education in the 1960s was one of the big reasons we got FDI. And I mean, stable governance structures, good infrastructure. We have this idea sometimes in Ireland that it's just about tax, but it's not just about tax. It is about so much more than that. And I think we need to not be complacent about that aspect of competitiveness.
Gary, Matt Cooper is writing about this in the Business Post as well. He's basically saying, let's not get embroiled in the airport passenger cap today. But he's basically kind of saying we need to get over ourselves with regard to data centres, yeah?
Yeah, it's time for the state to show its ambition to grow the economy and remove the brakes with stagnation in core sectors, which seems like a good old-fashioned sort of centre-right view of the world by Matt, who has written extensively, of course, about politics and economics, and has been banging on this drum for quite a while. And the opposite view, of course, is that you need regulation, and it was lax regulation which actually caused the crash of the global crash, but particularly here in Ireland, of 2008 onwards. But it is a huge issue, and to go to Ciara's point, certainly complacency, or where are all our sort of children going to get jobs in the future, where AI particularly is taking many of the or replicating many of those skills. And I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I would be slightly sceptical of Ian Guider's piece. Yeah, Britain is trying to get a lot of inward investment in. Of course, politically, Keir Starmer's had a car crash of 100 days in office. If you have to replace your chief of staff, as he has had to, within, you know, 3 months. So we have to wait and see how things pan out in Britain. But of course, I mean, Ireland is in competition with not just Britain, but all across the EU for foreign direct investment. And we certainly cannot risk
the EU
are
changing the rules now in ways that are not going to help us.
Indeed,
as well.
Yeah.
But listen, I want to crack on because I do want to get to the Middle East. Before we get into the actual stories here, Ciara, you lived in Lebanon for quite a while, did you?
Yeah, close to a year.
Yeah. So what are your observations then right now?
I think I'm just heartbroken to just continue to watch the region be trapped in this cycle of hatred and violence. I think, you know, obviously when Israel invaded, it just was despair at, you know, Israel has this narrative of all of our neighbours hate us, and then they do things.
It's not unjustified.
They do things that make it quite legitimate for their neighbours to hate them. And so you just recreate that cycle where then, you know, you also create legitimacy for groups that are attacking Israel or for terrorist organisations when you do things like, you know, bomb apartment buildings. So I suppose,
I mean, Hezbollah arose out of an Israeli invasion previously, didn't it?
Yeah.
What kind of country was it when you lived there? The texture of the place, like.
Yeah, I mean, it was deeply frustrating and very exciting. I mean, it's a real microcosm of the region. You have 18 recognized sects in the constitution, so you have, you know, which Lebanon do you want to talk about? Because you have the party Lebanon, you have the more conservative Lebanon, you have the agriculture Lebanon, you have the super urban kind of elite Lebanon as well. Just before I left, the dollars stopped coming out of ATMs. So you had the foreign currency crisis. And I have just watched the country crumble since then. Okay. Even at the time,
was it functional when you were there? Was there a functioning government?
It depends on your definition of functional.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, there was 12-hour electricity cuts every single day outside of the capital, 3-hour electricity cuts in Beirut. It was deeply corrupt. I mean, governance is just so poor. And has been for all of Lebanon's history, really. So I think.
And were Hezbollah this, you know, it's referred to as the state within a state and all that. Were they running the area you lived in, or was it run by the government, or what? Like, how does that work?
Oh, what is run by the government in Lebanon? Like, you know, it's an interesting country because people are so used to surviving without the government as well, or kind of getting by on their own. So Hezbollah kind of controlled some areas. But most of it didn't. But it, you know.
Okay, so there's no sense the way there is in Ireland that we wake up in the morning and we sense that somebody's in charge, the government, and they're running things. It's a completely different mindset to that, is it?
In a certain sense, there is. But the sense that those people are looking after your interests is definitely not there. You know, it's really those people run the country. The sense I got from normal Lebanese people, it was kind of a kleptocracy, right? They're running it to steal. Basically, as much as they can from it, and they don't really have that much of an interest in making the country better for ordinary citizens.
Okay, that's a fascinating insight, because I think a lot of us don't have a sense of that. Bobby, where do you think with your policy of optimism, we seem like further away than ever from any kind of diplomacy working here at all?
It's truly extraordinarily difficult to be optimistic about the situation, because Israel, and of course one has to say almost a year on from the atrocious Hamas attacks on Israel, that was appalling. But in its response to that, Israel has to take responsibility for its own actions. And it seems willing to stop at nothing with tens of thousands of civilians killed and even shooting at UN peacekeepers. I mean, Millwall Football Club had a slogan, "Nobody likes us, no one likes us, but we don't care." And it does seem that, you know, shooting at UN peacekeepers, which has now been condemned by dozens and dozens of countries around the world, shows that Israel isn't really amenable even to the United States. But I think...
So how do you see the diplomatic relationship with the United States at the moment? Because, like, there's this notion of ally, and, like, I saw the word ironclad used again the other night, like, that ironclad support for them to defend themselves and everything. But equally, like, it's a one-way street, is it? Like, they're given ironclad support, but they don't... Netanyahu doesn't feel the need to listen to the Americans anymore, does he?
Yes, I have no... I have no doubt that President Biden does his best to persuade Netanyahu to be more restrained in what the Israeli army is doing and not to try and provoke a wider conflict. But... He's essentially trapped by the fact that they're supporting them now,
and look, you can say they're right to do so, but they are supporting them now in a hit on Iran as well. And Iran are meeting...
I imagine that what they're doing is they're trying to persuade them to limit their attack on Iran. But at the same time, they have to send a very clear message from their own point of view that if Iran makes another attack on Israel, they will defend Israel. So they're trapped in an election year. But I think what we really mustn't lose sight of in all of this, with all the terrible things that are happening, is that the core problem is the treatment of the Palestinian people over decades. That's the core. That's the only way ultimately to solve it. The Palestinian people have an equal right to a state as the Israeli people do. And that is often lost sight of when we see the terrible horrors on a screen. So, for example, when people living in northern Israel complain absolutely justifiably that they've had to leave their homes because Hezbollah are sending rockets, I totally understand that. I don't think the media sufficiently reply and say, well, what about the Palestinian people
who not only have to... I think they do in this country, in fairness. But they don't do it
in the United States, which I think is the point.
And they don't do it in Israel.
The vast majority of Americans have no interest in foreign affairs, and those who have a slight interest in foreign affairs will back Israel to the hilt. They see it in very black and white terms.
Okay, just to give the other side to this, Gary, just because time is against us, just to give another side to it, though, you did pick Lucinda Creighton's piece as well. And look, this is not in any way to defend Israel or anything, but just pointing out high time that EU treats Iran as the terrorist state that it is.
Yeah, well, yeah. She says the threats posed by Iran are multifaceted, but European leaders have been rewarding its regime with futile diplomatic efforts. And it goes to the heart of this idea that Iran is sponsoring terror in the Middle East and has for many years and will continue for many years.
And is a big player in the war in Ukraine as well.
It's an enormous player there. And I mean, there's also a very good piece in the Sunday Times by Michael Clark, who's a very esteemed professor in the... in the Royal United Services Institute and King's College, making the point that Israel, what he calls its decapitation strategy, you go for the head of the leadership, no matter what the collateral damage is. But we know, and our history tells us, that when the leadership is cut, these groups, they regenerate from the bottom up. You saw it here with the IRA for decades. You're seeing it here as well with...
And because Iran will keep
funneling the money. So Lucinda has a very, very thought-provoking column. But again, like everyone else, doesn't have the solution. I would be very pessimistic because, you know, I've lived in the United States for a long time and followed its politics. The Democrats have been wedded to Israel since its foundation, and the Republicans are even more wedded to the idea of Israel. And a one-state solution rather than a two-state solution would be the view of many in the United States. And I'm sure President Biden is deeply frustrated, but any sure way to lose the election would be to say... would be to stop selling arms to Israel.
Kira, you wanted to come in there just to...
It was just on the decapitation strategy that, you know, there are instances where that has worked, but it's only where it's one influential leader who started a movement rather than legitimate grievances causing kind of that bottom-up grassroots movement when where it will just keep rearing its head.
Yeah, good point. Okay, we'll take a break. Bobby McDonagh, Sarah McGuinness, Kira Murphy and Professor Gary Murphy staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back, Bobby McDonagh, Sarah McGuinness, Ciara Murphy and Professor Gary Murphy still with us. Sarah McGuinness, the real story that the people on the streets are talking about, probably up in Leinster House as well, Traitors is coming to Ireland. Oh, you better tell people what Traitors is first.
It's my favourite TV show to ever air. So Traitors is takes place in the UK. It's coming into its third season now. It's fronted by Claudia Winkleman. And it's basically 22 strangers are pitted against each other in a remote castle. And they kind of play all these various games of strategy. And it was teed up as this kind of psychological reality TV show. But actually, it's possibly one of the most high camp TV shows I've ever seen. It's absolutely brilliant. They all have to kind of guess who the traitor is, and they have this big round table, and they all kind of say, "We think you're the traitor," and they point the finger, and it's very dramatic, very camp. Claudia Winkleman wears an extortionate amount of eyeliner throughout the whole thing, and leather gloves. There's ravens coming out sometimes. They have to do all this mad crap. At one point, they were had this ceremonial burying people alive if you thought they were the traitor. It's brilliant. Apparently, it's coming to Ireland now. And, you know, all the kids are talking about who's going to host it. So apparently, Jennifer Zamparelli is tipped 2-1 to take on the role of Claudia Winkleman.
Yesterday, the papers were all Lucy Kennedy.
Jennifer Zamparelli, Brendan. Okay,
I didn't see your name in there now.
And I know you're heartbroken about
the only one who's not. Yeah.
It sounds like we've come back to the Cobalt story.
Exactly.
Guess who the traitor is.
They've been playing traitors in the Dáil all week. And just finally, do we have time to talk about Wolves? We do. Ciara, the Irish Mail on Sunday. The Mail could never be accused of not being kind of slightly alarmist at times. So basically, Europe is being overrun by Wolves, is it?
That seems to be what they're going for. And they're looking at the Netherlands and, you know, Wolves have been gradually reintroduced, I think. And they're really, really important for biodiversity because they prevent the overrun of herbivores, which completely destroy an ecosystem.
So they're kind of an apex predator.
Exactly, which are crucial.
But do we want wolves running around? I'm nervous at the idea.
Yeah, I mean, and it's so interesting because I suppose if they had never been gone, they would have been a normal part of life. And I think there's some really interesting points that have been raised. You know, lots of people live near and around apex predators. A lot of these stories are from the Netherlands, which is one of the most highly densely populated countries in Europe. I do think it's interesting. It talks about EU regulations not allowing them to be hunted. And I think there's definitely conversations to be had around that. But I think there's some really interesting points about, you know, what's the benefit, right? You see there's a cost and it can be scary.
Yeah.
But for example, I remember looking at something about how many people are killed in car crashes with deers, for example. So you're not doing a full cost benefit analysis in this kind of scaremongering piece.
Okay, so we need to have a mature, balanced conversation about it. Okay.
Eamon Ryan wanted to reintroduce them, didn't he?
He did, yeah. But you see, the thing is, this is more Irish exceptionalism, right? We've nothing to do with world politics and we've no security and we're no danger to anyone. We also don't have any dangerous wildlife in this country. We don't want it either. Okay, thanks very much to my panel today. Bobby McDonagh, former Irish ambassador to the UK, the EU and Italy. Sarah McGuinness, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. Ciara Murphy, senior policy officer at the ESRI. And Professor Gary Murphy, professor of politics at DCU. Thanks a million, guys.